Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Rhino Podcast, brought to you by Rhino Records. Interviews with your favorite artists and bands about the songs and albums you love. Here's your host, Rich Mahan.
On this episode of the Rhino Podcast, our guest is Rock and Roll Hall of Famer John Densmore. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Rhino Podcast. As always, I'm joined by our good friend, John Hughes. John, how are you?
Hey, Rich. I'm doing okay here in the bunker.
He hunkered in the bunker. It's an odd time to go through the holidays for sure.
Well, you know, I don't like anybody anyway, so I'm good.
Isolation.
Exactly. Are you doing the Iggy Pop isolation, or which version are you doing?
I'm just kind of making one up to tune of Infatuation by Rod Stewart. So
I highly recommend the Iggy Pop isolation from Blah Blah Blah, produced by David Bowie. But that's another subject.
Adding that one to the playlist today for sure. But you know, when you're home alone, nothing helps like some music.
I'm telling you, it really does. And that's no BS. I put music on and I instantly feel a little more focused. I get back to work. I relax. You know, it's a cure-all.
And if you need new music, I cannot think of a better place to go than Rhino.com.
Especially now, because right now we have the Rhino Black Friday sale. And you know, Black Friday's not just on Black Friday anymore. It's like, you know, a whole week long celebration for a lot of places, and we're no exception. It's 15% off and free U.S. domestic shipping on vinyl, like Grateful Dead, American Beauty, 50th Anniversary Picture Disc. Also included are box sets like the Eagles Live from the Forum, which, you know, 15 bucks off and free shipping on that. I think it weighs like 700 pounds, so that's a good deal.
Yeah, no kidding. On your heavy items, this is the time to grab them, folks.
And 15% off and free shipping on Rhino.com exclusives, like the Lou Reed New York Deluxe box set, stuff that you can't get on any other outlet. So right now is the time to check out Rhino.com.
That's right. And, you know, grab them for yourself, but also, obviously, folks, for the music people in your life, these make great gifts.
Yeah, hurry, because those shipping deadlines are coming up quick.
What else we got for the folks?
The Doors, Morrison Hotel, 50th Anniversary Deluxe Edition, that's out now. Two CDs, one LP collection, freshly remastered by you-know-who, longtime Doors engineer and mixer Bruce Botnick. It also has a bonus disc of an hour plus of unreleased studio outtakes from the Morrison Hotel sessions. So, man, if you're a Doors fan, this is a must-have.
Absolutely. And John Densmore and I get into that in this interview coming up here in a second. So great stuff on that set. If you're a Doors fan, you really need to check it out.
Perfect timing. Also, here's one that's near and dear to my power pop loving heart. Roxette, Bag of Tricks, music from the Roxette vaults. This is four LPs of 46 previously unreleased or long since deleted Roxette recordings. These are demos, alternative mixes, Spanish language versions, bonus tracks, other fun stuff from Roxette's long, illustrious, and extraordinary career, which spanned 20 years from 86 to 2016. And if you've never really explored Roxette, they kind of have this unfair image in the U.S. as being this fluffy pop band. They're really kind of a power pop band in disguise, and we actually have a really good talk with Pear from Roxette coming up on the Rhino Podcast next month.
It was really interesting. One of the things from that talk that I walked away with was how huge the band stayed outside the U.S. after they kind of waned a little here. Yeah, they remained huge all over the world.
and who he was hanging out with in L.A. when he came out here in the early 80s to do songwriting. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but you will be shocked.
Yeah, no, we had a great conversation with him. It was very cool.
Can't wait to hear it.
Well, John, have a great holiday this week, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks, Rich.
Our guest this week is John Densmore. He's, of course, best known as the drummer for The Doors, who have very recently released the 50th anniversary deluxe edition of their penultimate album with Jim Morrison, Morrison Hotel. But he's also a songwriter, actor, and most importantly, in the case of this episode, author. John has a new book out now entitled The Seekers, Meetings with Remarkable Musicians and Other Artists, where he investigates his own relationship with creativity and explores the meaning of artistry through his recollections of conversations with other artists, performers, and luminaries. Today, John tells us some of these stories himself. John, thanks very much for joining us on the Rhino Podcast.
Rhino Podcast.
The Rhino Podcast. We finally got you on, man. Been wanting to have you for a while. You've got a brand new book, The Seekers, which is out now. Let's just start with the cover work, actually. Shepard Fairey did it. Really cool imagery. Talk about that for a sec.
I wrote about all these musicians, some famous, some not, who, you know, fed me creatively.
Yeah.
Shepard had this cool idea of taking a photograph of me and tweaking it, you know, like he did with Obama, but then putting around my head several of these icons, trying to make it look like they're part of my DNA, which they are. They fed me as I grew up, and I took things from Elvin Jones and Patti Smith, you know, jumped from musician to winning the National Book Award as a writer. Oh my God. So that's inspiring to me as a musician slash writer.
Yeah, sure.
That's the cover. I'm very pleased with the cover.
Yeah, well, you know, a fancy wrapper makes you want to see what's inside. This is your third book. How did the idea for this one come around? And who is Sam Joseph and how did he help you with that?
Oh, Sam Joseph is a longtime friend and he's a writer and editor. You know, he's one of my friends that read it early in the stages. And how did I do that? I mean, how do I work this? David Byrne reference.
Yeah, right. Yeah. For those of you in audio land out there, John did do the arm movement when he said
right.
<that.
laughs> Sorry, I forgot. Just audio. I couldn't believe I did another book. After each book, I went, oh my God, I'm done. This, you know, to try and get an overview of several hundred pages takes years. And when you're done, you're like, okay. And then I wrote another one and then another one. The first two were The Doors, Riders on the Storm and The Doors Unhinged, were kind of, I would say, written in blood. They were a cathartic experience that I had to get out.
Yeah.
The Seekers is written in love. It's a tip of the hat to all these great artists that helped nurture me. And I'm hoping not only will the readers get inspired by hearing about these various famous and not famous people, but they also will get fed, let's see, music is medicine for the soul. Boy, these days it's everybody's so uptight, and music can calm you down. And you can also play music, and you don't have to be a professional. I wrote this, that if you're playing your piano in your closet, nobody hears it, it doesn't matter. You're kind of getting in that same time zone of sort of tapping into infinity, and it feeds you, your soul. So yeah. I hope they
right.
get that
right.
too.
I think besides just the soul too, I think it also makes you feel better physically. I mean, Grace Slick, she tells that great story about she was going on stage, but she was so hungover. But as soon as she started singing, she felt fine. And it was like, as long as she was singing and making music, she felt great. So I think it has more than just a soothing thing for the soul. You're absolutely right there. But I think it's very powerful, and we don't realize it sometimes.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Rich, the last paragraph in the chapter on Ravi Shankar is, I'm paraphrasing, but he's playing and he's 94 or something, you know.
Yeah.
For that hour or two, the aches and pains went away.
Yeah.
So.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I thought it was, since you mentioned Ravi, you mentioned in there that your back was giving you some problems as a result of the way you played, kind of leaning over the drum kit, but you wouldn't change a thing because it lent itself to becoming part of your style and your sound. And Ravi Shankar's back, he also mentioned that his back was twisted from the way that he sat playing the sitar for so many years.
Yeah. You try and improve the situation, you know. Yeah. When I was back in the day, you know, I think later, Mick Fleetwood had a friggin' masseuse and chiropractor on the road with him. You know, you, yeah. you learn yeah. stuff.
Right, sure.
But to your point, if you're doing something that you care about, you know, everybody has occupational hazards.
Yeah.
And the dues you pay is worth it.
Right.
That's why I say in there, you know, the all those thousands of guys who built a skyscraper ought to have their name at the bottom, not just the logo of the corporation, you know?
Right. Or the architect in the lobby, you know? Right. I love the line in the intro by Viggo Mortensen. It says, children do not separate themselves as artists or non-artists. So why as adults do we make that delineation? What happens between being a child and an adult where we look at that differently? Something must change. Is it society that forces us to label one way or the other?
Wow. That's a deep question. You know, if one is so fortunate to make a living off of art, and I have a formula for that. It's in three stages and it's in this order. First, luck.
Right, right, right. Right place, right time.
Yeah. Second, chutzpah or hustle.
Yeah.
Third, talent. Why is that last? Because there's a lot of talented people that are starving, and there's a lot of really famous people that are not very talented.
That's true. So, it's very true.
Yeah. Maybe if you're not making a living at art, you know, music, painting, whatever it is, writing, then maybe you feel lesser and you project on the artist. You kind of put him on a pedestal a little bit or a lot.
Yeah.
And what Vigo's trying to get at is, you know, like I said, this stuff is medicine for the soul. Go in during tumultuous times and that'll take care of you like now. Or do a painting, even if you can't paint, or take a walk or whatever, right. Mindful walk, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. What does it mean to be a seeker? Because I think you're kind of leading toward that right there.
I think in the conclusion, I quote Dylan, they're saying, "What Reuben Carter, the Hurricane
yeah,
Carter.
Yeah, sure,
the
Hurricane, boss, yeah, yeah know, right.
Who Bob wrote about and helped get out of jail. He says to Bob, what are you after? What are you looking for all the time? And he said, the grail. In other words, it's not the goal. It's the path. And a true artist is always seeking. And it's great to get trophies or play Madison Square Garden. But I can get off, like after the Doors' big peak, I'd do poetry in a little club. But if it was the right moment, that dance between the audience and me, I get off as much or more than Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
I don't know. It's just a feeling, you know, that there's a connection.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if it's a 40-piece orchestra or a duet and the audience is a club or 10,000 people. Tonight, you're going to dance together. You're one person and that entity is the other person. And the excitement is the live. What's it going to be tonight? A salsa, a waltz? You don't know. And that's the connection. And that's what's exciting. And my next thought is really depressing because of this pandemic. And God, are we all starved for the community of live music?
Isn't that true?
Ugh. But we will get out of this, okay? Okay?
Yeah we will.
No, we will.
Yeah, we will. When you started out as a young musician, your mom signed you up. You took piano lessons. You tell this great story in there about your parakeet that you bring out on the keys that you would play with. That's yeah. really cool. But what led you from piano to drums. What brought you to drums initially?
My orthodontist.
Really?
Yeah, I knew I loved music. After the piano, I wanted to play any instrument. In the second chapter, my music teacher is Mr. Armour. I wanted to play clarinet, and I had braces. The dentist said, no. We're trying to push your teeth back. That instrument will push them out. So Mr. Armour, chapter two, music teacher, says, well, you know, we need drummers. And I know you can't play piano in the orchestra or the marching band or the dance band. So I go, drum. Well, girls are attracted to drummers. Yeah, drums. Yeah.
Yeah. You say you learned about ensemble playing from your high school band program, which is, boy, I would like to see more music in schools because I think it really offers something to kids that you can't get any way else. But that's what. Yeah,
all right, let me make a jump.
Yeah.
David Byrne's thing. What's it called? American Utopia?
Yeah, the new show he's put together.
Yeah. Did you see it?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Let me just say that not only are those musicians the absolute highest world-class caliber musicians, people don't realize doing all that choreography and wearing those drum things, which I did in the marching band, the strap is real heavy.
Yeah.
Wow. Herculean. Drumline hadn't been out when I was in high school. It was not cool to be a musician. You were a nerd. You're right. It fed me that the ensemble of all the bands, dance band, orchestra, the Doors are a really tight quartet.
Absolutely.
And that's the key. You serve the, you get more than the whole if the ingredients serve, you know?
Did things naturally fall together for you in the Doors, or did you guys have to like work for a little while to like find your spaces where you weren't stepping on each other? Or was it one of those things that just clicked right away?
Well, we first started jamming on the blues because that was familiar and Jim loved the blues. And then we started fooling around with our own stuff, made that transition. And it was, I mean, we really only rehearsed for about a year and a half before we got a club gig. And then a few months later, we got a record deal.
That's crazy.
That sounds quick. But each of us individually, before we met, were studying our instrument, or Jim was reading a slew of books. And so when we got together, we were sort of ready. And I brought jazz influence, and Robbie brought folk and flamenco, and Ray had the Chicago blues and classical music, you know. The intro to Let My Fire is a Bach kind of riff.
Right.
And so it did all kind of just coalesce.
In the chapter about Ray, you guys mentioned the very first time that you jammed together in his parents' garage down in Manhattan Beach. What was that like playing with him for the first time? And was there anybody else jamming with you guys, or was it just you two?
No, Ray's two brothers were playing guitar and harmonica. Robbie was not in the band yet. Well, you know, like I said to Ray, you know, we talked, and he had the same love of jazz musicians that I did. And
yeah.
And then I said, you know, do you know All Blues by Miles Davis? And he went, yeah. And so we started playing. And then, I mean, in four bars, I knew that we had the same feel.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the key. You know, like to drummers, one beat is really long and you can lay back and that's the blues, or you can push it on the front like marching band military music. And so you got to have a feel together. And we'd play Miles or we'd play the blues and we were one.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I knew that this is going to at least be really fun. I mean, we had no idea we were going to be 50 years later. I'm still talking about this friggin' band.
The Doors don't sound like anybody else, John. I know you know that. You've heard that so many times too, but it's true. You guys are singularly unique. The sound that the four of you guys made it's never even come close. There's no band that sounds like the Doors. Part of it is that Ray is basically two instruments in the band. It's a, you know, him playing the piano bass with his left hand, and there's a great section in there that talks about you and he going to the music store and having to put like mental blinders on so you didn't get sidetracked by the albums. I love that part. And get back to the musical instrument section, and you got the Rhodes piano bass. I wanted to ask you this question that I'm leading to for a long time. When you guys started using bass players in the studio, like from Morrison Hotel and L.A. Woman, Lonnie Mack and Ray Neapolitan played on Morrison Hotel, which is out now and sounds great, by the way. How did you adjust to not playing with Ray playing bass and playing with these other bass players? Did you guys try to search out a bass player that had a similar feel to Ray's left hand, or did you just adjust?
Way back to the very beginning, we even had Larry Nechtel, a famous studio musician, bass player, overdub, even on the first album, Ray's bass lines because there were no Moog synthesizers. And recording-wise, the keyboard bass kind of was mushy and it needed more punch. Okay. It needed the pluck of a string. So we overdubbed from a bass. And even later, when we actually played with bass players in the studio, they were still duplicating Ray's lines.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And so I was used to it. It was right. Natural. You
know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But let me say something about maybe our uniqueness comes from all these ingredients, flamenco, jazz, Chicago blues, all stirred into this gumbo, and it's kind of like an American melting pot. And maybe that's why we're unique and lasting.
Yeah. Speaking about music and bass and starting out a major, what makes the one so powerful?
Oh, really good. It's interesting. I wrote a few chapters on various musicians like Elvin Jones, John Coltrane's drummer, or Ravi Shankar, which were really impactful on my life.
Yeah.
And then I thought, what the hell? My mom encouraged me to play piano, and I'll write about her. And then later, just a week ago or so, I thought, oh, now I know why I put her at the front. Because in the chapter, I think it's on Elvin Jones, I talk about how to us drummers and to everyone else, the first drum beat you heard was in the womb. It was your mom's heartbeat.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And just a week ago, it hit me. Oh, yeah. Of course, mom's first. I was in the womb with in her womb.
Totally.
That's the one. And that's, it's a homeland security. It feels good. Everybody.
Yeah, right.
That's the reason people dance. That's the reason people move when they hear music, you know? So that's the one. And as I said, you can push it or lay back on it, but that's the pocket. It's gotta be in the parameters of before the next beat comes, somewhere in there. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, love that. In your Lou Reed chapter, you quote several of his songs, but you only name one of his albums, New York. Why is that a standout Lou Reed work for you?
That one, I think every song's a masterpiece. That's why I did that. But I was trying to be real honest when I first heard the Velvet Underground at the Whiskey. It was like, what the? I don't know. And then I started to realize that, I mean, his whole concept of playing guitar was like playing it like a drum, practically, you know?
Yeah.
And the gritty street lyrics, man, I started to really get it. And I learned from it. You know, yeah. I'm from the West Coast, so.
Sure.
That was a great revelation. Boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool to hang with him a little bit.
Oh, I bet. Every song on that record is great. Love it.
And risky.
And so risky. But the payoff, that's part of the payoff.
Yeah.
How is writing a book different for you than making a record?
My goodness. Well, records take a few months. Books take a few years. If you're playing a song, you spend a few minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes playing the song for an overview. A book, you spend 2 or 3 days reading the damn thing to try and get an overview. So yeah. It's rather linear.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about, okay, I've written about really diverse musicians, like Gustavo Dudamel is the young classical conductor of the LA Philharmonic. And then I got Bob Marley, and wait a minute, how do these people connect? Oh, sound. They love sound. The painters see the world, musicians hear it. That's the connection. And if you see Bob Marley play on a video or Dudamel, they're so into it that their entire bodies are emanating the sound you're hearing. And that's the connection.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And everyone else can get in that space too. You know, play music and don't worry about whether you're climbing the charts. That'd be great. It's healing salve.
It's its own reward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rich.
Yeah. One of the things I like about this book is I got a feeling of who you are by reading about your encounters with other people. I thought that was really cool. In a way, have you thought about this book as a sort of autobiography?
Well, I guess it is, sort of.
Yeah.
So this is my third self-centered memoir? I was trying to compliment all these other musicians, but of course I got to, rather than just say, oh, she's great, he's great, I got to say, what's my connection to them? Why did they pull on my creative juices? And so then it gets personal. And the personal is interesting because, you know, you hear anecdotes of meeting Paul Simon and talking about something that happened 50 years before, you know?
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.
You do tell a story about talking with Paul Simon backstage. I believe the more modern meeting between the two of you was backstage at the Ryman here in Nashville. But you opened for Simon and Garfunkel in 1968, and you apologized to Paul. Jim was maybe rude and disconnected, but Paul came to wish you guys luck, and Jim was kind of aloof. And Paul suggested maybe he was nervous.
I apologized to Paul 50 years later.
Yes.
and to my surprise, he said, I remember that. He wanted to help the young band who was opening for him. And then the guy was kind of aloof.
Yeah.
And then the guy becomes this giant icon in leather pants. So Paul is probably scratching his head for 50 years. And we had kind of a healing. He said, maybe Jim was nervous. And I went, that's it.
Yeah.
It was, you know, kind of defensive or whatever. And I think about Paul Simon, who's, I don't know, I'm 76. He's pushing 80, I don't know, 78 or 9. And then there's Willie, who's 86 or 7 or whatever.
Yeah.
And these two guys are great mentors for me as how to do it different from Jim, who checked out at 27.
Yeah.
You know, and it's good to have different examples because there's many roads to the grail.
You got a meet and greet with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
The story that you tell of meeting him involves a recurring theme in your book, and that space. In this case, with the Dalai Lama, it was a lack of space that led to the point of your story. You made eye contact with him and you felt like you couldn't not, you were really just, that was your jam. And it was too heavy for him too. And he kind of moved you along in the meet and greet line. And does music suffer the same fate when there isn't space? What is it about space that makes music special?
Oh, wow. Well, first let me back up.
All right.
I was being a little rude, maybe like Jim was with Paul Simon, with the Dalai Lama. You know, I was looking into his eyes with the question, are you as great as you're supposed to be?
Okay, yeah.
You know, it was, you know, and I got my Zen slap, which is what I deserve. And I also felt kind of teary being around him. So there's something going on there.
Yeah.
So wait, so space in music. Yeah. It's paramount. It's the whole thing for me. Like, I'm not the fastest drummer, but I play very dynamically. I learned that from these ensembles. If you have space and you have drama and then silence, and then you have everything in between, you have the whole human experience kind of. There's something really sacred about the space. If it was all sound and no silence, it wouldn't differentiate. You wouldn't care.
Right.
And then I throw in some stuff about metaphysics, kind of that the black holes are, according to scientists, more important than matter. And if in the beginning was the word, to musicians, in the beginning was sound, vibration.
Yeah.
We're all connected, vibratory.
Well, and I think that that's one of the things that makes music so special and moving for people, is that vibration. It's something that you feel and you can't always articulate, but feeling things is kind of the first step in perception of the world.
And it's a direct hit to the heart. You know, you look at a painting, music is in the air, and there's some sound that's making me cry or laugh. What is that? Well, that's some kind of magic. Like I said, it's medicine, and it is very powerful. Countries get rid of musicians because it's messing up their politics. So,
yeah, you know. It does communicate in ways that words can't. Back to the space, because I really love the idea of space and music, and it is so important into, one, creating your own sound. And in, along those lines, you mentioned that one of the things that you think makes Willie's guitar playing so unique is his phrasing. And really, when you think about it, phrasing is the space that you put between the notes.
Exactly.
So there's space again. And then again, in the Ram Dass chapter, you talk about how after he had the stroke, it didn't bring him down. It actually, he found things to explore after his stroke, using the stroke or working within the new parameters of his abilities. And one of the things was his speech was limited and it created more space. And so you mentioned that it made the things he said more powerful in a way.
Yeah. And so when I first saw Gustavo Dudamel conduct the LA Phil as a guest conductor, you know, he'd conduct Beethoven or something. It would be a half an hour, really heavy, strong stuff.
Yeah.
And then he finished, like, you can't see my hands, but he'd hold it up when he finished the piece. And then he would just keep his hands up for, I don't know, a friggin' minute. And then he put them down, and then you knew it was okay to applaud. And that just killed me, because you needed a minute of silence after all that sound. You needed that space. And it was so powerful. It was like a meditation, you know?
Yeah.
And so all this stuff connects.
Right.
Meditation, phrasing with guitar. I'm not the fastest drummer, but I like space. In the end, it's real quiet. And then I hit a big tom-tom boom. I don't know why. And then it gets more powerful because of that. As I get older, I realize that if I put the right cymbal crash in the right spot, it's as powerful as all the flashy stuff I did in my 20s.
Yes.
If it's in the right spot.
Right.
So that's all about space.
And as Ram Dass wrote, the quieter you become, the more you can hear.
Yeah, right. Good line.
I know, great line. And it seems obvious, but when you read it, you're like, oh, of course. You know what I mean? It's something that is so obvious sometimes that it just kind of goes over your head. How wonderful would it be if more people listen to hear versus listen to respond?
Oh, wow. That's good. Well, it would be a lot less stress going on. That's
oh, yeah.
For sure.
No doubt.
We can all work on that.
Yeah, well, I'll try to. It's hard. <you know? laughs> The world is a noisy place. You have stood on the stage at the Ryman in Nashville here and at the Disney Music Center in L.A., and you snapped to hear or clapped to hear the acoustics in each room. Which do you prefer?
I'm sorry. The Ryman and the Walt Disney Concert Hall are the same.
Really?
They're all wood. you know?
Yeah.
The Ryman's got wood benches. The L.A. Phil has these big wood sticks behind the organ and wood. So once again, it's womb-like. You feel comfort and warmth. Wood is warm. Like if you hear a wood flute, you can hear the wood. If you hear a metal flute, it's beautiful, but there's something acoustically you get from acoustic instruments versus electric.
Yes.
So the Ryman and the Walt Disney Concert Hall are on the same level acoustically.
How crazy. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You have this wonderful 50th anniversary edition of Morrison Hotel that just came out. And
yeah, right.
Disc two, the bonus material, has you guys really work in Queen of the Highway. You get to listen to it as you progress through it. And there's all this great studio banter that we get to hear. You get to be a fly on the wall as you guys are cutting this track.
She was a princess, queen of the highway. Sign on the road said, take us to Madre. No one could save her, save the blind tiger. He was a monster, black dressed in leather.
Okay, we gotta watch. Oh, we're getting into it too fast. That's what's happening.
Well, the first note comes in too fast.
No, I mean too hard. We're playing it too hard in the first verse.
This was the last album that you did with Paul Rothchild, and your next album, L.A. Woman, you guys produced yourself along with Bruce Botnick, your longtime engineer.
Correct.
How was it making this record with Paul? Because those two records to me seemed to be almost side A and side B. Was Paul kind of more hands-off on this last record that he worked with you, or was it business as usual with Paul?
Paul taught us how to make records, and he was really great. Yeah. But after a while, we knew how to do it.
Yeah.
So he got a little overzealous on too many takes, and that was sort of the middle period. Waiting for the Sun and Soft Parade, album 3 and 4, he would just have us do so many takes, it was getting ludicrous, too perfectionistic.
Wow.
But we wanted to try and make Sgt. Pepper, so we did horns and strings on Soft Parade, and critics dissed us for changing our precious sound, but we needed to do that. We had thought about it from the beginning as a creative road to travel, which got us back to Morrison Hotel and L.A. Woman, which were more blues-based. Mm-hmm. And Paul knew that, and he helped us with that. And we, like L.A. Woman, we took it even further and did it in our own rehearsal room.
Right.
And it was almost like a garage band. And that's our roots, the blues. And what's the blues on Morrison Hotel? The Lonnie Mack.
Roadhouse Blues.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we're back home in the garage, and that felt good.
Let it roll, baby, roll. Let it roll, baby, roll. Let it roll, baby, roll. Let it roll. Hey. All night long.
So that's the arc.
Yeah.
And Paul, you know, we said goodbye to him, and then we producing L.A. Woman ourselves was fed us. We had more control.
And another artist that Paul worked with was Janis Joplin.
Yep.
What was it like seeing Janis Joplin sing live for the first time in San Francisco?
Yeah. I described the scene in the book. So I'm at the Fillmore West. We're playing with the Airplane and James Cotton Blues Band, I think. We're on a break. The bass player from the Airplane, Cassidy, says to me and Robbie, our guitar player, you got to go over and see Big Brother. You got enough time. I went, what? Oh, you know, there's two more acts. Okay, we got an hour, hour and a half. Yeah. We're supposed to get in our car and drive to go to see some Nazi group? What is this? And he said, no, the singer, you got to go. I said, okay. So we jump in the car. It's crazy. In the middle of our show, I mean, you know, we're on a break. And we go into the Avalon and go up the stairs. And immediately in the very back, I'm hearing this voice and thinking, oh, boy. Whoa. I mean, you know, we're talking Bessie Smith or Aretha or something here. Whoa.
Really? She was cutting that well above the band and the crowd. You could really hear her voice.
Yeah. And so we worked our way up to the edge of the stage, and she was singing Down on Me, Down on Me. I just, I knew. Like, I've been really blessed to, I was at Shelley's Manhole, and I saw John Coltrane before he took a rocket ship.
I can only imagine. Only imagine.
I saw Gustavo Dudamel before he became this incredible conductor. I saw reggae before it even came to the States. And I don't know, my intuition has fed me about seeking out new creative energy. And I knew Janis had it. I mean, I just knew it. I went backstage and we shared some wine, and I just said, hey, we got to go back and play our gig, but keep doing it. And
yeah.
Wow. Yeah. You know, kind of a sad situation. She was loved by everybody, and she never really found a mate. You know, like Jim, they're both kind of tragic.
Yeah. So what was her quote? It's like, I make love to 25,000 people, and then I go home alone.
That was her quote.
Yeah.
And then I quote a story that Jim told about a dream he had that we had played a concert, and he goes back to his hotel room, and he's going down the hallway, and he hears a bunch of people in his room. And he said, whoa, is this the right number? And then he pushes the door open, and there's a bunch of people in there, and they look at him like, who's that? And they go on partying. And that's the end of the dream. I thought, whoa, that's prophetic.
Yeah. Well, when you guys were on tour, when the incident in Miami happened, and a bunch of your tour got canceled, basically, so you thought, well, let's go to Jamaica for a week. And that was 69? Is that correct?
Around yeah.
Okay. The first time you went to Jamaica, what was that like?
Well, that was, beautiful island. It was interesting because certainly herb was there.
Yeah, right.
As in ganja, but there were no dreadlocks yet, but we're exposed to early ska and reggae.
Who was the big artist? Was Desmond Dekker real popular then?
Yeah. We went back. Later, Robbie and I had a band and went to Jamaica because Phil Chin, wonderful bass player, played with Rod Stewart.
Sure.
And Jeff Beck wanted to see his parents. And yeah, okay, let's finish this out. I'm in Jamaica. And then, wow, then we saw Jimmy Cliff in the studio. And reggae was not in the States. Nobody knew anything about it.
Right.
So that was kind of luck. I'm saying I had this intuition for creative, just sniffing out creative juices. But coming back from England to finish this album, we just stumbled into reggae. And when I got home, I had Kenny Edwards, the late bass player of Linda Ronstadt, come over, and I said, listen to this music, listen to the bass lines. They're real melodic. They don't care about the groove. It's weird stuff.
And they have a ton of space.
Yeah, good one, Rick. That's good.
They
oh,
do.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If they had filled it all up like a Motown thing, it would not be reggae.
Absolutely.
Reggae is space. Excellent.
Yeah.
And, like Kenny said, what is this called? Reggie? No, reggae. And then a year later, Linda had number one cover of Many Rivers to Cross.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Well, isn't that the great thing about artists hanging out and sharing ideas? It leads to beautiful art.
Yeah.
Well, this book that you've written is beautiful. There's so many good stories in it, and it's heartfelt. You can tell your passion for music and art is evident.
Thank you.
What plans do you have to promote this pandemically speaking? I mean, are you going to do any sort of live streams, any readings online? Do you have anything going on?
Yeah. I am going to do a Book Soup virtual reading with David Frick, I think. He's the Rolling Stone writer.
Yes.
He's going to interview me. So, great. Yeah, I'm going to do all that.
I saw you and Perry Farrell do something at Book Soup many years ago. It was over 10 years ago now. But the two of you played together. It was great to see you play the hand drum.
I remember that, and a year from now, there'll be a paperback next holiday, and maybe, wear some wood,
Yeah, right?
Maybe I'll get to hang. Be nice.
I hope so. Thank you so much for your time, man. Really great talking with you.
Hey, great. Thanks, Rich. But I'm not feeling well without you. Oh, what can I do? You make me real. You make me feel like lovers feel. You make me throw away my thinking misery. Make me feel up. Make me free.
I really enjoyed that conversation. I love talking about the things that make music special, and especially those aspects that aren't obvious. You Doors fans should pick up the new Morrison Hotel 50th Anniversary Deluxe Edition. It's a remastered version of the original album on 180-gram vinyl, has two CDs, the second being all studio outtakes, which offer a ton of info about how the Doors worked in the studio. And you heard some of that bonus material this episode, but the remastering of the album really wins the blue ribbon in this deluxe edition. It sounds great and brings out detail that makes it sound brand new. Be well, folks. We'll see you next time. Thanks very much for tuning in. Don't forget to listen and subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss the next Rhino podcast. Producer for Rhino Entertainment, John Hughes. Produced for Rhino Entertainment by Rich Mayhem Promotions. All rights reserved.